Rita Blakemore was smiling both at him and with him, and he was struck again by her casual yet elegant handsomeness. She looked like a woman from an Irwin Shaw novel, Night Work, maybe, or the one they had made for TV some years ago. "When I heard you coming, I almost hid," she said. "I thought you were probably the man with the broken glasses and the queer philosophy." "The monster shouter? Is that what you call him or what he calls himself?"
"What I call him."
"Very apt," she said, opening her mink-trimmed, maybe, bag and taking out a package of menthol cigarettes. "He reminds me of an insane Diogenes."
"Yeah, just looking for an honest monster," Larry said, and laughed again.
She lit her cigarette and chuffed out smoke.
"He's not sick either," Larry said, "but most of the others are."
"The doorman at my building seems very well," Rita said. "He's still on duty. I tipped him $5 when I came out this morning. I don't know if I tipped him for being very well or being on duty. What do you think?"
"I really don't know you well enough to say."
"No, of course you don't." She put her cigarettes back in her bag, and he saw that there was a revolver in there. She followed his gaze. "It was my husband's. He was a career executive with a major New York bank. That's just how he put it when anyone asked what he did to keep himself in cocktail onions. I am a career executive with a major New York bank. He died 2 years ago. He was at a luncheon with one of those Arabs who always look as if they have rubbed all the visible areas of their skin with Brill cream. He had a massive stroke. He died with his tie on. Do you think that could be our generation's equivalent of that old saying about dying with your boots on? Harry Blakemore died with his tie on. I like it, Larry."
A finch landed in front of them and pecked the ground.
"He was insanely afraid of burglars, so he had this gun. Do guns really kick and make a loud noise when they go off, Larry?"
Larry, who had never fired a gun in his life, said, "I don't think one that size would kick much. Is it a 38?
"A 32.
She took it out of her bag, and he saw that there were also a good many small pill bottles in there. This time she didn't follow his gaze. She was looking at a small chinaberry tree about 15 paces away.
"I believe I'll try it. Do you think I can hit that tree?"
"I don't know," he said apprehensively. "I don't really think..." She pulled the trigger, and the gun went off with a fairly impressive bang. A small hole appeared in the chinaberry tree.
"Bullseye," she said, and blew smoke from the pistol barrel like a gunfighter.
"Real good," Larry said. And when she put the gun back in her purse, his heart resumed something like its normal rhythm.
"I couldn't shoot a person with it. I'm quite sure of that. And soon there won't be anyone to shoot, will there?"
"Oh, I don't know about that."
"You were looking at my rings. Would you like one?"
"Huh?
No."
He began to blush again.
"As a banker, my husband believed in diamonds. He believed in them the way the Baptists believe in revelations. I have a great many diamonds, and they are all insured. We not only owned a piece of the rock, my Harry and I sometimes believed we held a lien on the whole goddamn thing. But if someone should want my diamonds, I would hand them over. After all, they're only rocks again, aren't they?"
"I guess that's right."
"Of course," she said, and the tick on the side of her neck jumped again. "And if a stick-up man wanted them, I'd not only hand them over, I would give him the address of Cartier's. Their selection of rocks is much better than my own."
"What are you going to do now?" Larry asked her.
"What would you suggest?"
"I just don't know," Larry said, and sighed.
"My answer exactly."
"You know something? I saw a guy this morning who said he was going out to Yankee Stadium and masturbate on home plate. Can you imagine?"
He could feel himself blushing again.
"What an awful walk for him," she said. "Why didn't you suggest something closer?"
She sighed, and the sigh turned into a shudder. She opened her purse, took out a bottle of pills, and popped a gel capsule into her mouth.
"What's that?" Larry asked.
"Vitamin E," she said with a glittering false smile. The tick in her neck jumped once or twice and then stopped. She became serene again.
There's nobody in the bars, Larry said suddenly. I went into Pat's on 43rd, and it was totally empty. They have that great big mahogany bar, and I went behind it and poured myself a water glass full of Johnny Walker. Then I didn't even want to be there, so I left it sitting on the bar and got out. They sighed together like a chorus. You are very pleasant, she said. I like you very much. Thank you, Mrs. Blakemore. He was surprised and pleased. Rita, I'm Rita. Okay. Are you hungry, Larry? As a matter of fact, I am. Perhaps you'd take the lady to lunch. That would be a pleasure. She stood up and offered him her arm with a slightly deprecatory smile. As he linked his through it, he caught a whiff of her sachet, a smell that was at once comforting and disquietingly adult in its associations for him, almost old. His mother had worn sachet on their many trips to the movies together. Then he forgot about it as they walked out of the park and up Fifth Avenue, away from the dead monkey, the monster shouter, and the dark, sweet treat sitting endlessly inside the comfort station on transverse number one. She chattered incessantly, and later he could remember no one thing she had chattered about. Yes, just one. She had always dreamed, she said, of strolling up Fifth Avenue on the arm of a handsome young man. A young man who could have been her own son, but who wasn't. But he recalled the walk often, just the same, especially after she began to jitter apart like some indifferently made toy. Her beautiful smile, her light, cynical, casual chatter, the whisper of her slacks. They went into a steakhouse, and Larry cooked, a trifle clumsily, but she applauded each course. The steak, the French fries, the instant coffee, the strawberry rhubarb pie. Chapter 22. There was a strawberry pie in the fridge. It was covered with saran wrap, and after looking at it for a long time with dull and bemused eyes, Franny took it out. She set it on the counter and cut a wedge. A strawberry fell to the counter with a fat plop as she was transferring the piece of pie to a small plate. She picked the berry up and ate it. She wiped up the small splotch of juice on the counter with a dish rag. She put the saran wrap back over the remains of the pie and stuck it back in the refrigerator. She was turning back to get her pie when she happened to glance at the knife rack beside the cupboards. Her father had made it. It was two magnetized runners. The knives hung from them, blades down. The early afternoon sun was gleaming on them. She stared at the knives for a long time, the dull, half-curious cast of her eyes never changing, her hands working restlessly in the folds of the apron tied around her waist. At last, some 15 minutes later, she remembered that she had been in the middle of something. What? A line of scripture, a paraphrase, occurred to her for no good reason. Before removing the mote in thy neighbor's eye, attend the beam in thine own. She considered it. Mote? Beam? That particular image had always bothered her. What sort of beam? Sunbeam? Moonbeam? Roofbeam? There were also flashlight beams and beaming faces, and there had been a New York mayor named Abe Beam, and before removing the mote in thy neighbor's eye. But it wasn't an eye. It was a pie. She turned to it and saw there was a fly crawling on her pie. She waved a hand at it. Bye-bye, Mr. Fly. Say so long to Franny's pie. She regarded the piece of pie for a long time. Her mother and father were both dead, she knew. Her mother had died in the Sanford Hospital, and her father, who had once made a little girl feel welcome in his shop, was lying dead in bed above her head. Why did everything have to keep coming in rhymes? Coming and going in such dreadful cheap jingles and jangles, like the idiot mnemonics that recur in fevers. My dog has fleas, they bite his knees. She sat there for almost an hour, her plate before her, the dull, half-questioning expression on her face. Little by little, another thought began to surface in her mind. Two thoughts, actually, that seemed at once connected and totally unrelated. Were they maybe interlocking parts of a bigger thought? Keeping an ear open for the sound of dropping ice cubes inside the refrigerator's ice-making gadget, she examined them. The first thought was that her father was dead. He had died at home, and he might have liked that. The second thought had to do with the day. It was a beautiful summer's day, flawless, the kind that the tourists came to the Maine seacoast for. You don't come to swim because the water's never really warm enough for that. You come to be knocked out by the day. The sun was bright, and Franny could read the thermometer outside the back kitchen window. The mercury stood just under 80 degrees. It was a beautiful day, and her father was dead. Was there any connection, other than the obvious tear-jerky one? She frowned over it, her eyes confused and apathetic. Her mind circled the problem, then drifted away to think of other things. But it always drifted back. It was a beautiful, warm day, and her father was dead. It came home to her all at once, and her eyes squeezed shut, as if from a blow. At the same time, her hands jerked involuntarily on the tablecloth, yanking her plate off onto the floor. It shattered like a bomb, and Franny screamed, her hands going to her cheeks, digging furrows there. The wandering, apathetic vagueness disappeared from her eyes, which were suddenly sharp and direct. It was as if she had been slapped hard, or had an open bottle of ammonia waved under her nose. You can't keep a corpse in the house, not in high summer. The apathy began to creep back in, blurring the outlines of the thought. The full horror of it began to be obscured, cushioned. She began to listen for the clunk and drop of the ice cubes again. She fought it off. She got up, went to the sink, ran the cold water on full, and then splatted cupped handfuls against her cheeks, shocking her lightly perspiring skin. She could drift away all she wanted, but first this thing had to be solved. It had to be. She couldn't just let him lie in bed up there as June melted into July. It was too much like that Faulkner story that was in all the college anthologies, A Rose for Emily. The town fathers hadn't known what that terrible smell was, but after a while it had gone away. It. No, she cried out loud to the sunny kitchen. She began to pace, thinking about it. Her first thought was the local funeral home. But who would... Stop backing away from it, she shouted furiously into the empty kitchen. Who's going to bury him? At the sound of her voice, the answer came. It was perfectly clear. She was, of course. Who else? She was. It was 2:30 in the afternoon when she heard the car turn into the driveway, its heavy motor purring complacently, low with power. Franny put the spade down on the edge of the hole, she was digging in the garden between the tomatoes and the lettuce, and turned around, a little afraid. The car was a brand new Cadillac Coupe de Ville, bottle green, and stepping out of it was a fat 16-year-old, Harold Lauder. Franny felt an instant surge of distaste. She didn't like Harold and didn't know anyone who did, including his late sister Amy. Probably his mother had. But it struck Fran with a tired sort of irony that the only person left in a gunquit besides herself should be one of the very few people in town that she honestly didn't like. Harold edited the Ogunquit High School literary magazine and wrote strange short stories that were told in the present tense or with the point of view in the second person or both. He whacks off in his pants, Amy had once confided to Fran. How's that for nasty? Wax off in his pants and wears the same pair of undershorts until they'll just about stand up by themselves. Harold's hair was black and greasy. He was fairly tall, about 6'1", but he was carrying nearly 240 pounds. He favored cowboy boots with pointed toes, wide leather garrison belts that he was constantly hitching up, and flowered shirts that billowed on him like stay sails. Franny didn't care how much he whacked off, how much weight he carried, or if he was imitating Wright Morris this week or Hubert Selby Jr. But looking at him, she always felt uncomfortable and a little disgusted, as if she sensed by low-grade telepathy that almost every thought Harold had was coated lightly with slime. She didn't think, even in a situation like this, that Harold could be dangerous, but he would probably be as unpleasant as always, perhaps more so. He hadn't seen her. He was looking up at the house. "Anybody home?" he shouted. then reached through the Cadillac's window and honked the horn. The sound jagged on Franny's nerves. She would have kept silent, except that when Harold turned around to get back into the car, he would see the excavation and her sitting on the end of it. For a moment, she was tempted to crawl deeper into the garden and just lie low until he got tired and went away. Stop it, she told herself. Just stop it. He's another living human being, anyway. Over here, Harold, she called. Harold jumped, his large buttocks joggling inside his tight pants. Obviously, he had just been going through the motions, not really expecting to raise anyone. He turned around, and Fran walked to the edge of the garden, resigned to being stared at in her white gym shorts and her halter. Harold's eyes crawled over her with great avidity. Say, Fran, he said happily. Hi, Harold. I'd heard that you were having some success in resisting the dread disease, so I made this my first stop. I'm canvassing the township. He smiled at her, revealing teeth that had a nodding acquaintance at best with his toothbrush. I was awfully sorry to hear about Amy, Harold. Are your mother and father? I'm afraid so, Harold said. He bowed his head for a moment, then jerked it up, making his clotted hair fly. But life goes on, does it not? I guess it does, Fran said wanly. His eyes were on her breasts again, dancing across them, and she wished for a sweater. How do you like my car? It's Mr. Brannigan's, isn't it? Roy Brannigan was a local realtor. It was, Harold said indifferently. I used to believe that in these days of shortages, anyone who drove such a thyroidal monster ought to be hung from the nearest Sunoco sign, but all of that has changed. Less people means more petrol. Petrol, Fran thought dazedly. He actually said petrol. More everything, Harold finished. His eyes took on a fugitive gleam as they dropped to the cup of her navel, rebounded to her face, dropped to her shorts, and bounced to her face again. His smile was both jolly and uneasy. Harold, if you'll excuse me, but whatever can you be doing, my child? The unreality was trying to creep back in again, and she found herself wondering just how much the human brain could be expected to stand before snapping like an overtaxed rubber band. My parents are dead, but I can take it. Some weird disease seems to have spread across the entire country, maybe the entire world, mowing down the righteous and the unrighteous alike. I can take it. I'm digging a hole in the garden my father was weeding only last week, and when it's deep enough, I guess I'm going to put him in it. I think I can take it. But Harold Lauder in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac, feeling me up with his eyes and calling me my child? I don't know, Lord. I just don't know. Harold, she said patiently, I am not your child. I am 5 years older than you. It is physically impossible for me to be your child. Just a figure of speech, he said, blinking a little at her controlled ferocity. Anyway, what is it, that hole? It's a grave, she said, for my father. Oh, Harold Lauder said in a small, uneasy voice. I'm going in to get a drink of water before I finish up. To be blunt, Harold, I'd just as soon you went away. I'm upset. I can understand that, he said stiffly. But Fran, in the garden? She had walked past him toward the house, and now she rounded on him, furious. Well, what would you suggest? That I put him in a coffin and drag him out to the cemetery? What in the name of God for? He loved his garden. And what's it to you, anyway? What business is it of yours? She was starting to cry. She turned and ran for the kitchen, almost running into the Cadillac's front bumper. She knew Harold would be watching her jiggling buttocks, storing up the footage for whatever X-rated movie played constantly in his head, and that made her angrier, sadder, and more weepy than ever. The screen door whacked flatly shut behind her. She went to the sink and drank 3 cold glasses of water too quickly, and a silver spike of pain sank deeply into her forehead. Her surprised belly cramped, and she hung over the porcelain sink for a moment, eyes slitted closed, waiting to see if she was going to throw up. After a moment, her stomach told her it would take the cold water, at least on a trial basis. Fran? The voice was low and hesitant.
She turned and saw Harold standing outside the screen, his hands dangling limply at his sides. He looked concerned and unhappy, and Fran suddenly felt badly for him. Harold Lauder tooling around the sad, ruined town in Roy Brannigan's Cadillac. Harold Lauder, who had probably never had a date in his life, and so affected what he probably thought of as worldly disdain. For dates, girls, friends, everything. Harold, I'm sorry. No, I didn't have the right to say anything. Look, if you want me to, I can help. Thank you, but I'd rather do it alone. It's personal. Of course, I understand. She could have gotten a sweater from the kitchen closet, but of course he would have known why, and she didn't want to embarrass him again. She went back out on the porch, and for a moment they stood there looking at the garden, at the hole with the dirt thrown up around it. And the afternoon buzzed somnolently around them as if nothing had changed. "What are you going to do?" she asked Harold. "I don't know," he said. "You know," he trailed off. "What?" "Well, it's hard for me to say. I am not one of the most loved persons in this little patch of New England. I doubt if a statue would ever be erected in my memory on the local common, even if I had become a famous writer, as I had once hoped. Parenthetically speaking, I believe I may be an old man with a beard down to my belt buckle before there is another famous writer." She said nothing, only went on looking at him. "So," Harold said, and his body jerked as if the word had exploded out, "so I am forced to wonder at the unfairness of it. The unfairness seems, to me at least, so monstrous that it is easier to believe that the louts who attend our local citadel of learning have finally succeeded in driving me mad." He pushed his glasses up on his nose, and she noticed with sympathy how really horrible his acne problem was. Had anyone told him, she wondered, that soap and water would take care of some of that? Or had they all been too busy watching pretty, petite Amy as she zoomed through the University of Maine with a 3.8 average, graduating 23rd in a class of over 1,000? Pretty Amy, who was so bright and vivacious where Harold was just abrasive. "Mad," Harold repeated softly. "I've been driving around town in a Cadillac on my learner's permit. And look at these boots." He pulled up the legs of his jeans a little, disclosing a gleaming pair of cowboy boots, complexly stitched. $26. I just went into the shoe boat and picked out my size. I feel like an imposter, an actor in a play. There have been moments today when I've been sure I was mad." "No," Franny said. He smelled like he hadn't had a bath in 3 or 4 days, but this no longer disgusted her. "What's that line? I'll be in your dream if you'll be in mine. We're not crazy, Harold." "Maybe it would be better if we were." "Someone will come," Franny said, "after a while, after this disease, whatever it is, burns itself out." "Who?" "Somebody in authority," she said uncertainly. "Somebody who will, well, put things back in order." He laughed bitterly. "My dear child, sorry, Fran. Fran, it was the people in authority who did this. They're good at putting things back in order. They've solved the depressed economy, pollution, the oil shortage, and the Cold War all at a stroke. Yeah, they put things in order, all right. But it's just a funny strain of the flu, Harold. I heard it on the radio. Mother Nature just doesn't work that way, Fran. You're somebody in authority, got a bunch of bacteriologists, virologists, and epidemiologists together in some government installation to see how many funny bugs they could dream up. And they dreamed up a dilly. What are you going to do, Fran?" "Bury my father," she said softly. "Oh, of course." He looked at her for a moment and then said very swiftly, "Look, I'm going to get out of here, out of a gun quit. If I stay much longer, I really will go crazy. Fran, why don't you come with me?"
"Where?"
"I don't know, not yet." "Well, if you think of a place, come ask me again." Harold brightened. "All right, I will. It..." He trailed off and began to walk down the porch steps in a kind of daze. His new cowboy boots gleamed in the sun. Fran watched him with sad amusement. He waved just before climbing behind the wheel of the caddy. Fran lifted a hand in return. The car jerked unprofessionally when he put it in reverse, and then he was backing down the driveway in fits and starts. He wandered to the left, crushing some of Carla's flowers under the offside wheels, and nearly thumped into the culvert ditch as he turned out onto the road. Then he honked twice and was gone. Fran watched until he was out of sight, and then went back out to her father's garden. Sometime after 4 o'clock, she went back upstairs with dragging footsteps, forcing herself along. There was a dull headache in her temples and forehead, caused by heat and exertion and tension. She had told herself to wait another day, but that would only make it worse. Under her arm, she carried her mother's best damask tablecloth, the one kept strictly for company. "I love you, Daddy," she said. "I love you. Franny loves you." Her tears fell on his face and gleamed there. She removed his pajamas and dressed him in his best suit, hardly noticing the dull throb in her back, the ache in her neck and arms as she lifted each part of his weight, dressed it, dropped it, and went on to the next part. She propped his head up with 2 volumes of the Book of Knowledge to get his tie right. In his bottom drawer, under the socks, she found his army medals, Purple Heart, Good Conduct medals, campaign ribbons, and the bronze star he had won at Anzio. She pinned them to his lapel. In the bathroom, she found Johnson's baby powder and powdered his face and neck and hands. The smell of the powder, sweet and nostalgic, brought the tears on again. Sweat slicked her body. There were pitted dark circles of exhaustion under her eyes. She folded the tablecloth over him, got her mother's sewing kit, and closed the seam. Then she doubled the seam and sewed again. With a sobbing, whistling grunt, she managed to get his body to the floor without dropping it. Then she rested, half swooning. When she felt she could go on, she lifted the top half of the corpse, got it to the head of the stairs, and then, as carefully as she could, down to the first floor. She stopped again, her breath coming in quick, whining gasps. Her headache was sharp now, needling into her with quick, hard bursts of pain. She dragged the body down the hall, through the kitchen, and out onto the porch, down the porch steps. Then she had to rest again. The golden light of early evening was on the land now. She gave way again and sat beside him, her head on her knees, rocking back and forth, weeping. Birds twittered. Eventually, she was able to drag him into the garden. At last, it was done. By the time the last sods were back in place, she had fitted them together down on her knees as if doing a jigsaw puzzle. It was 9:15. She was filthy. Only the flesh around her eyes was white. That area had been washed clean by her tears. She was reeling with exhaustion. Her hair hung against her cheeks in matted strings. "Please be at peace, Daddy," she muttered. "Please." She dragged the spade back to her father's workshop and slung it inside indifferently. She had to rest twice as she climbed the 6 steps to the back porch. She crossed the kitchen without turning on the lights and kicked off her low-topped sneakers as she entered the living room. She dropped to the couch and slept immediately. In the dream, she was climbing the stairs again, going to her father, to do her duty and see him decently under the ground. But when she entered the room, the tablecloth was already over the body, and her sense of grief and loss changed to something else, something like fear. She crossed the darkened room, not wanting to, suddenly wanting only to flee, but helpless to stop. The tablecloth glimmered in shadows, ghostly, ghastly, and it came to her. It wasn't her father under there. And what was under there was not dead. Something, someone, filled with dark life and hideous good cheer was under there. And it would be more than her life was worth to pull that tablecloth back, but she couldn't stop her feet. Her hand reached out, floated over the tablecloth, and snatched it back. He was grinning, but she couldn't see his face. A wave of frigid cold blasting up at her from that awful grin. No, she couldn't see his face, but she could see the gift this terrible apparition had brought for her unborn baby, a twisted coat hanger. She fled from the room, from the dream, coming up, surfacing briefly in the 3 o'clock darkness of the living room, her body floating on the foam of dread, the dream already tattering and unraveling, leaving behind it only a sense of doom, like the rancid aftertaste of some rotten meal. She thought, in that moment of half-sleeping and half-waking, him, it's him, the walking dude, the man with no face. Then she slept again, this time dreamlessly, and when she woke the next morning, she didn't remember the dream at all. But when she thought of the baby in her belly, a feeling of fierce protectiveness swept over her all at once, a feeling that perplexed her and frightened her a little with its depth and strength. Chapter 23. That same evening, as Larry Underwood slept with Rita Blakemore, and as Franny Goldsmith slept alone, dreaming her peculiarly ominous dream, Stuart Redman was waiting for Elder. He had been waiting for 3 days, and this evening, Elder did not disappoint him. At just past noon on the 24th, Elder and 2 male nurses had come and taken away the television. The nurses had removed it while Elder stood by, holding his revolver, neatly wrapped in a baggie, on Stu. But by then, Stu hadn't needed the TV. It was just putting out a lot of confused shit anyway. All he had to do was stand at his barred window and look out at the town on the river below. Smoke was no longer billowing from the stacks of the textile mill. The gaudy pools of dye runoff and the river had dissipated. Most of the cars, glittering and toy-like from this distance, had left the mill's parking lot and hadn't come back. By yesterday, the 26th, there were only a few cars still moving on the turnpike, and those few had to weave between the stalls like skiers in a slalom race. No wreckers had come to remove the stopped vehicles. The downtown area was spread out below him like a relief map, and it seemed totally deserted. The town clock, which had chimed off the hours of his imprisonment here, had not tolled since 9 this morning, when the little tune that preceded the striking had sounded draggy and run down. There had been a fire at what looked like a roadside cafe, or maybe a general store just outside of town. It had burned merry hell all this afternoon, black smoke etching against the blue sky, but no fire engines had come to put it out. If the building hadn't been set in the middle of an asphalt parking lot, Stu supposed that half the town might have gone up. Tonight, the ruins were still smoldering in spite of an afternoon spat of rain. Stu supposed that Elder's final orders were to kill him. Why not? He would only be one more corpse, and he knew their little secret. They had been unable to find a cure or to discover how his bodily makeup varied from all those who had succumbed. The thought that there would be precious few left he could tell their secret to had probably never even entered their computations. He was a loose thread. Stu was sure that a hero in a television program or a novel could have thought of a way to escape, even some people in real life, but he wasn't one of them. In the end, he had decided with a certain panicky resignation that the only thing to do would be to wait for Elder and just try to be ready. Elder was the clearest sign that this installation had been breached by what they sometimes called blue and sometimes the superflu. The nurses called him Dr. Elder, but he was no doctor. He was in his mid-50s, hard-eyed and humorless. None of the doctors before Elder had felt a need to hold a gun on him. Elder scared Stu because there would be no reasoning or pleading with such a man. Elder was waiting for orders. When they came, he would carry them out. He was a spear carrier, the army version of a mafia button man, and it would never occur to him to question his orders in the light of ongoing events. 3 years ago, a friend of Stu's had recommended a book called Watership Down, and although Stu didn't read much, one weekend was so boring and rainy that he had taken it out of the library, hoping that it would be a story about mutiny at sea. The thing turned out to be about rabbits, for Christ's sake, the stupidest, most cowardly animals on God's earth.
Except the guy who wrote that book made them seem different. He really cared about them. It was a pretty damn good story, and Stu, who read it at snail's pace, finished it that same weekend. The thing he remembered most from that book was a phrase, going Tharn, or just Tharn. He understood it at once, because he had seen plenty of Tharn animals and run down a few on the highway. A Tharn animal would crouch in the middle of the road, its ears flattened, watching as a car rushed toward it, unable to move from the certain oncoming death. Elder made Stu feel like that. He would look into Elder's flat blue eyes and feel all the will drain out of him. Elder probably wouldn't even need the pistol to dispose of him. Elder probably had had courses in karate, savate, and general dirty tricks. What could he possibly do against a man like that? Just thinking about Elder made his will to even try want to drain away. Tharn. It was a good word for a bad state of mind. The red light went on over the door at just past 10 p.m., and Stu felt light perspiration break on his arms and face. It was this way every time the red light went on, because one of these times Elder would be alone. Because he wouldn't want witnesses. There would be a furnace somewhere to cremate plague victims. Elder would bundle him into it. Snip. No more loose end. Elder stepped through the door. Alone. Stu was sitting on his hospital bed, one hand resting on the back of his chair. At the sight of Elder, he felt the familiar sickening drop in his belly. He felt the familiar urge to spill out a flood of loose, pleading words, in spite of his knowledge that such pleas would avail him nothing. There was no mercy in that face. Now everything seemed very clear to him, very colorful, very slow. He could almost hear his eyes rolling in their bed of lubrication as he followed Elder's progress into the room. He was a big man, stocky, and his white suit was stretched too tight over him. The hole at the end of the pistol he held looked tunnel size. "How are you feeling?" Elder asked, and even through the tinny speaker, Stu could hear the nasal quality of Elder's voice. Elder was sick. "Just the same," Stu said, surprised at the evenness of his voice. "Say, when do I get out of here?" "Very soon now," Elder said. He sneezed. "You don't talk much, do you?" Stu shrugged. "I like that in a man," Elder said. "You're big talkers. They're your whimperers and whiners and bellyachers. I just got the word on you about 20 minutes ago, Mr. Redman. They're not such hot orders, but I think you'll do okay." "What orders?" "Well, I've been ordered to..." Stu's eyes flicked past Elder's shoulder toward the high, riveted sill of the airlock door.
"Jesus Christ," he exclaimed. "That's a fucking rat. What kind of a place are you running with rats in it?"
Elder turned, and for a moment, Stu was almost too surprised by the unexpected success of his ruse to go on. Then he slid off the bed and grasped the back of his chair in both hands as Elder began to pivot toward him again. Elder's eyes were wide and suddenly alarmed. Stu lifted the chair over his head and stepped forward, swinging it down, getting every ounce of his 180 behind it.
"Get back there," Elder cried. "Don't..."
The chair crashed down on his right arm. The gun went off, disintegrating the baggie, and the bullet screamed off the floor. Then the gun fell to the carpet, where it discharged again. Stu was afraid he could count on only one more blow with the chair before Elder fully recovered himself. He determined to make it a good one. He brought it around in a high, hard arc, a Henry Aaron home run swing. Elder tried to get his broken right arm up and couldn't. The legs of the chair crashed into the hood of the white suit. The plastic faceplate splintered into Elder's eyes and nose. He screamed and fell backward. He rolled onto all fours and scrambled for the gun lying on the carpet. Stu swung the chair one last time, bringing it down on the back of Elder's head. Elder collapsed. Panting, Stu reached down and grabbed the gun. He stepped away, pointing it at the prone body, but Elder didn't move. Stu was trembling all over, and suddenly the need to get out of there was so strong that he almost bolted blindly through the airlock door and into whatever lay beyond. He had been locked up for over a week, and all he wanted now was to breathe fresh air and then get far, far away from this terrible place. But it had to be done carefully.
Stu walked to the airlock, stepped in, and pushed a button marked cycle. An air pump went on, ran briefly, and the outer door opened. Beyond it was a small room with a desk. On the desk was a thin stack of medical charts and his clothes, the ones he had been wearing on the airplane from Braintree to Atlanta. The cold finger of dread touched him again. Those things would have gone into the crematorium with him, no doubt. His charts, his clothes. So long, Stuart Redmond. Stuart Redmond would have become an unperson. In fact, there was a slight noise behind him, and Stu turned around fast. Elder was staggering toward him, crouched over, his hands swinging loosely. A jagged splinter of plastic was lodged in one oozing eye. Elder was smiling. "Don't move," Stu said. He pointed the gun, steadying it with both hands, and still the barrel jittered. Elder gave no sign that he had heard. He kept coming. Wincing, Stu pulled the trigger. The pistol bucked in his hands, and Elder stopped. The smile had turned into a grimace, as if he had been struck with a sudden gas pain. There was now a small hole in the breast of his white suit. For a moment he stood, swaying, and then he crashed forward. For a moment, Stu could only stare at him, frozen, and then he blundered into the room where his personal effects were piled on the desk. He tried the door at the far end of the office, and it opened. Beyond the door was a hallway lit by muted fluorescence. Halfway down to the elevator bank, an abandoned gurney cart stood by what was probably the nurse's station. He could hear faint groaning. Someone was coughing, a harsh ratcheting sound that seemed to have no end. He went back into the room, gathered his clothes up, and put them under one arm. Then he went out, closed the door behind him, and started down the hall. His hand was sweating against the grip of Elder's gun. When he reached the gurney, he looked behind him, unnerved by the silence and the emptiness. The coffer had stopped. Stu kept expecting to see Elder creeping or crawling after him, intent on carrying out his final directive. He found himself longing for the closed and known dimensions of his room. The groaning began again, louder this time. At the elevators, another corridor ran at right angles to this one, and leaning against the wall was a man Stu recognized as one of his nurses. His face was swelled and blackened, his chest rising and falling in quick spurts. As Stu looked at him, he began to groan again. Behind him, curled in a fetal position, was a dead man. Further down the hall, there were another three bodies, one of them female. The male nurse, Vic, Stu remembered his name as Vic, began to cough again.
"Jesus," Vic said. "Jesus, what are you doing out? You're not supposed to be out."
"Elder came to take care of me, and I took care of him instead," Stu said. "I was lucky he was sick."
"Sweet bleeding Jesus, you better believe you was lucky," Vic said.
And another coughing fit, this one weaker, tore loose from his chest.
"That hurts, man. You wouldn't believe how that hurts. What a fuck-up this got to be. Bleeding Christ."
"Listen, can I do anything for you?" Stu asked awkwardly.
"If you're serious, you can put that gun in my ear and pull the trigger. I'm ripping myself to pieces inside."
He began to cough again, and then to groan helplessly. But Stu couldn't do that, and as Vic's hollow groans continued, Stu's nerve broke. He ran for the elevators, away from that blackish face like the moon in partial eclipse, half expecting Vic to call after him in that strident and helplessly righteous voice that the sick always seem to use when they need something from the well. But Vic only went on groaning, and that was somehow worse. The elevator door had shut and the car was already moving downward when it occurred to Stu that it might be booby-trapped. That would be just their speed. Poison gas, maybe, or a cutout circuit that would disengage the cables and send the elevator careering down the shaft to crash at the bottom. He stepped into the middle of the car and looked around nervously for hidden vents or loopholes. Claustrophobia caressed him with a rubber hand, and suddenly the elevator seemed no more than telephone booth size, then coffin size. Premature burial, anyone? He reached out a finger to push the stop button, and then wondered what good that would do if he was between floors. Before he could answer the question, the elevator slid to a smooth, normal stop. What if there are men with guns out there? but the only sentinel when the door slid back was a dead woman in a nurse's uniform. She was curled up in a fetal position by a door marked ladies. Stu stared at her so long that the door began to slide shut again. He put his arm out, and the door bounced obediently back. He stepped out. The hallway led down to a T-junction, and he walked toward it, taking a wide berth of the dead nurse. There was a noise behind him, and he whirled, bringing the gun up, but it was only the elevator door sliding shut for the second time. He looked at it for a moment, swallowed hard, then walked on. The rubber hand was back, playing tunes on the base of his spine, telling him to hell with this walk-don't-run bit. Let's get out quick before someone, something, can get us. The echoes of his footfalls in this semi-dark corridor of the administration wing was too much like macabre company. Come to play, Stuart? Very good. Doors with frosted glass panels marched past him, each with its own tale to tell. Dr. Sloan, records and transcripts. Mr. Ballinger, microfilm, copy file, Mrs. Wiggs. Perhaps of the cabbage patch, Stu thought. There was a drinking fountain at the T-junction, but the warm, chlorinated taste of the water made his stomach turn. There was no exit to his left. A sign on the tile wall, with an orange arrow beneath, read, Library Wing. The corridor seemed to stretch away for miles down that way. Some 50 yards down was the body of a man in a white suit, like some strange animal cast up on a beach. His control was getting bad. This place was much, much bigger than he had first assumed. Not that he'd had a right to assume much of anything from what he'd seen when he was admitted, which had been two halls, one elevator, and one room. Now he guessed it to be the size of a largish metropolitan hospital. He remembered taking Norma, his wife, to a big hospital in Houston when they diagnosed the cancer. Every place you went in there, they had little maps on the walls with little arrows pointing at a dot. The words written on each arrow said, "You are here." They put those up so people wouldn't get lost, like he was now. Lost. He could stumble around for hours, his footfalls echoing and rebounding, coming across corpses strewn here and there like prizes in a ghastly treasure hunt. "Don't go far now, you're almost home free," he said. And his words echoed back, flat and strange. He hadn't meant to speak aloud, and that made it worse. He turned to the right, setting his back to the library wing, walked past more offices, came to another corridor, and turned down that. He began to look behind himself frequently, assuring himself that no one, elder maybe, was following him, but unable to believe it. The hallway ended in a closed door that said Radiology. A hand-lettered sign hung on the knob. Closed until further notice, Randall. Stu went back and peered around the corner, and back where he had come from. The dead body in the white suit was tiny with distance now, hardly more than a speck, but seeing it there so changeless and eternal made him want to run away as fast as he could. He turned right, setting his back to it again. 20 yards further up, the corridor branched into another T-junction. Stu turned right and went past more offices. The corridor ended at the microbiology lab. In one of the lab carrels, a young man clad in jockey shorts lay sprawled over his desk. He was comatose and bleeding from the nose and mouth. His breath rattled in and out with a sound like October wind in dead corn husks. And then Stu did begin to run, turning from one corridor to another, becoming more and more convinced that there was no way out, at least not from this level. The echo of his footfalls chased him, as if either Elder or Vic had lived just long enough to put a squad of MPs on his trail. Then another fancy crowded that out, one he somehow associated with the queer dreams he had been having the last few nights. The idea grew so strong that he became afraid to turn around, afraid that if he did, he would see a white-suited figure striding after him, a white-suited figure with no face but only blackness behind the plexiglass plate. Some dreadful apparition, a hitman from beyond sane time and space. Panting, Stu rounded a corner, sprinted 10 feet before he realized the corridor was a dead end, and crashed into a door with a sign over it, The sign read, Exit. He pushed at the bar, convinced it would be locked, but the door opened easily. He went down four steps to another door. To the left of this landing, more stairs went down into thick darkness. The top half of the second door was clear glass reinforced with crisscrossed safety wire. Beyond it was only the night, the beautiful, mellow summer night, and all the freedom a man ever dreamed of. Stu was still staring out, transfixed, when the hand slipped out of the darkness the stairs descended into and grasped his ankle. A gasp tore at Stu's throat like a thorn. He looked around, his belly a freezing flow of ice, and beheld a bloody, grinning face upturned in the darkness.
Come down and eat chicken with me, beautiful, it whispered in a cracked and dying voice. It's so dark.
Stu screamed and tried to pull free. The grinning thing from the darkness held on, talking and grinning and chuckling. Blood or bile was trickling from the corners of its mouth. Stu kicked at the hand holding his ankle, then stomped it. The face hanging in the darkness of the stairwell disappeared. There was a series of thudding crashes, and then the screams began. Of pain or of rage, Stu could not tell. He didn't care. He battered against the outside door with his shoulder. It banged open, and he tottered out, pinwheeling his arms to keep his balance. He lost it anyway and fell down on the cement path. He sat up slowly, almost warily. Behind him, the screams had stopped. A cool evening breeze touched his face, dried the sweat on his brow. He saw with something very like wonder that there was grass and flower beds. Night had never smelled as fragrantly sweet as this. A crescent moon rode the sky. Stu turned his face up to it thankfully, and then walked across the lawn toward the road which led to the town of Stovington below. The grass was dressed with dewfall. He could hear wind whispering in the pines. I'm alive, Stu Redmond said to the night. He began to cry. I'm alive, thank God, I'm alive. Thank you, God, thank you, God, thank you. Tottering a little, he began to walk down the road. Chapter 24. Dust blew straight across the Texas scrubland. In the twilight, it created a translucent curtain that made the town of Arnett seem like a ghost image. Bill Hapscom's Texaco sign had blown down and lay in the middle of the road. Someone had left the gas on in Norm Bruett's house, and the day before a spark from the air conditioner had blown the whole place sky high, rattling lumber and shingles and Fisher-Price toys all over Laurel Street. On Main Street, dogs and soldiers lay dead together in the gutter. In Randy's Superette, a man in PJs lay draped over the meat counter, his arms hanging down. One of the dogs now lying in the gutter had been at this man's face before losing its appetite. Cats did not catch the flu, and dozens of them wove in and out of the twilit stillness like smoky shades. From several houses, the sound of television snow ran on and on. A random shutter banged back and forth. A red wagon, old and faded and rusty, the words Speedaway Express barely legible on its sides, stood in the middle of Durgin Street in front of the Indian Head Tavern. There were a number of returnable beer and soda bottles in the wagon. On Logan Lane, in Arnett's best neighborhood, wind chimes played on the porch of Tony Leominster's house. Tony's scout stood in the driveway, its windows open. A family of squirrels had nested in the back seat. The sun deserted Arnett, and the town grew dark under the wing of the night. The town was, except for the chirr and whisper of small animals and the tinkle of Tony Leominster's wind chimes, silent. And silent. And silent. Chapter 25. Someone had left the door open between maximum security and the cell block beyond it. The steel-walled length of corridor acted as a natural amplifier, blowing up the steady, monotonous hollering that had been going on all morning to monster size, making it echo and re-echo, until Lloyd Henreid thought that, between the cries and the very natural fear that he felt, he would go utterly and completely bug-shit.
Mother,
the hoarse, echoing cry came. Mother! Lloyd was sitting cross-legged on the floor of his cell. Both of his hands were slimed with blood. The light blue cotton shirt of his prison uniform was smeared with blood because he kept wiping his hands dry on it so he could get a better purchase. It was 10 o'clock in the morning, June 29th. Around 7 this morning, he had noticed that the front right leg of his bunk was loose, and since then he had been trying to unthread the bolts that held it to the floor and to the underside of the bed frame. He was trying to do this with only his fingers for tools, and he had actually gotten 5 of the 6 bolts. As a result, his fingers now looked like a spongy mess of raw hamburger. The 6th bolt was the one that had turned out to be the bitch kitty, but he was beginning to think he might actually get it. Beyond that, he hadn't allowed himself to think. The only way to keep back brute panic was not to think.
Mother!
He leaped to his feet, drops of blood from his wounded, throbbing fingers splattering on the floor, and shoved his face out into the corridor as far as he could, eyes bulging furiously, hands gripping the bars.
Shut up, cock knocker! He screamed. Shut up! You're driving me fucking batshit!
There was a long pause. Lloyd savored the silence as he had once savored a piping hot quarter pounder with cheese from McDee's. Silence is golden. He had always thought that was a stupid saying, but it sure had its points.
Mother!
The voice came drifting up the steel throat of the holding cells again, as mournful as a foghorn.
Jesus, Lloyd muttered. Holy Jesus. Shut up! Shut up! Shut up, you fucking dimwit!
Mother!
Lloyd turned back to the leg of his bunk and attacked it savagely, wishing again that there was something in the cell to pry it with, trying to ignore the throbbing in his fingers and the panic in his mind. He tried to remember exactly when he had seen his lawyer last. Things like that grew hazy very soon in Lloyd's mind, which retained a chronology of past events about as well as a sieve retains water. 3 days ago. Yes. The day after that prick Mathers had socked him in the balls. 2 guards had taken him down to the conference room again, and Shockley was still on the door. And Shockley had greeted him, "Why, here's the wise-ass pussbag. What's the story, pussbag? Got anything smart to say?" And then Shockley had opened his mouth and sneezed right into Lloyd's face, spraying him with thick spit. "There's some cold germs for you, pussbag. Everybody else has got one from the warden on down, and I believe in share the wealth. In America, even scummy douchebags like you should be able to catch a cold." Then they had taken him in, and the lawyer had given him some pretty good news. The judge who was supposed to hear Lloyd's case was flat on his back with the flu. 2 other judges were also ill, so the remaining bench warmers were swamped. Maybe they could get a postponement. "Keep your fingers crossed," the lawyer had said. Lloyd hadn't seen him since then, and now, thinking back on it, he remembered that the lawyer had had a runny nose himself and...
"Oh, Jesus!"
He slipped the fingers of his right hand into his mouth and tasted warm blood. But that frigging bolt had given a little bit, and that meant he was going to get it for sure. Even the mother shouter down there at the end of the hall could no longer bother him, at least not so badly. He was going to get it. After that, he would just have to wait and see what happened. He sat with his fingers in his mouth, giving them a rest. When this was done, he'd rip his shirt into strips and bandage them.
"Mother?"
"I know what you can do with your mother," Lloyd muttered.
That night, after he had talked to his lawyer for the last time, they had begun taking sick prisoners out, carrying them out, not to put too fine a point on it, because they weren't taking anyone that wasn't far gone. The man in the cell on Lloyd's right, Trask, had pointed out that most of the guards sounded pretty snotty themselves. "Maybe we can get something out of this," Trask said. "What?" Lloyd had asked. "I don't know," Trask said. He was a skinny man with a long bloodhound face who was in maximum security while awaiting trial on charges of armed robbery and assault with a deadly weapon. "Postponements," he said. "I don't know." Trask had 6 joints under the thin mattress of his bunk, and he gave 4 of them to one of the screws who still seemed okay to tell him what was going on outside. The guard said people were leaving Phoenix, bound for any place. There was a lot of sickness, and people were croaking faster than a horse could trot. The government said a vaccine was going to be available soon, but most people seemed to think that was crap. A lot of the radio stations from California were broadcasting really terrible things about martial law and army blockades and rumors of people dying by the tens of thousands. The guard said he wouldn't be surprised to find out that the long-haired com-simp pervos had done it by putting something into the water. The guard said he was feeling fine himself, but he was going to get the Christ out just as soon as his shift was over. He had heard the Army was going to roadblock US-17 and I-10 and US-80 by tomorrow morning, and he was going to load up his wife and kid and all the food he could get his hands on and stay up in the mountains until it all blew over. He had a cabin up there, the guard said, and if anyone tried to get within 30 yards of it, he would put a bullet in his head. The next morning, Trask had a runny nose and said he felt feverish. He had been nearly gibbering with panic, Lloyd remembered as he sucked his fingers. Trask had yelled at every guard that passed to get him the fuck out before he got really sick or something. The guards never even looked at him, or at any of the other prisoners, who were now as restless as underfed lions in zoo cages. That was when Lloyd started to feel scared. Usually there were as many as 20 different screws on the floor at any given time. So how come he had only seen 4 or 5 different faces on the other side of the bars? That day, the 27th, Lloyd had begun eating only half of the meals that were thrust through the bars at him and saving the other half, precious little, under his bunk mattress. Yesterday, Trask had gone into sudden convulsions. His face had turned as black as the ace of spades and he had died. Lloyd had looked longingly at Trask's half-eaten lunch, but he had no way to reach it. Yesterday afternoon, there had still been a few guards on the floor, but they weren't carrying anyone down to the infirmary, no matter how sick. Maybe they were dying down in the infirmary, too, and the warden decided to stop wasting the effort. No one came to remove Trask's body. Lloyd napped late yesterday afternoon. When he woke, the maximum security corridors were empty. No supper had been served. Now the place really did sound like the lion house at the zoo. Lloyd wasn't imaginative enough to wonder how much more savage it would have sounded if maximum security had been filled to its capacity. He had no idea how many were still alive and lively enough to yell for their supper, but the echoes made it sound like more. All Lloyd knew for sure was that Trask was gathering flies on his right, and the cell on his left was empty. The former occupant, a young jive-talking black guy who had tried to mug an old lady and had killed her instead, had been taken to the infirmary days back. Across the way, he could see 2 empty cells and the dangling feet of a man who was in for killing his wife and his brother-in-law during a penny Pocino game. The Pocino killer, as he had been called, had apparently opted out with his belt, or if they had taken that, his own pair of pants. Later that night, after the lights had come on automatically, Lloyd had eaten some of the beans he had saved from 2 days ago. They tasted horrible, but he ate them anyway. He washed them down with water from the toilet bowl and then crawled up on his bunk and clasped his knees against his chest, cursing Poke for getting him into such a mess. It was all Poke's fault. On his own, Lloyd would never have been ambitious enough to get into more than small-time trouble. Little by little, the roaring for food had quieted down, and Lloyd suspected he wasn't the only one who'd been squirreling away some insurance. But he didn't have much. If he had really believed this was going to happen, he would have put away more. There was something in the back of his mind that he didn't want to see. It was as if there was a set of flapping drapes in the back of his mind, with something behind them. You could only see the bony, skeletal feet below the hem of the drapes. That's all you wanted to see, because the feet belonged to a nodding, emaciated corpse, and his name was Starvation. "Oh, no," Lloyd said. "Someone's going to come. Sure they are. Just as sure as shit sticks to a blanket." But he kept remembering the rabbit. He couldn't help it. He had won the rabbit and a cage to keep him in at a school raffle. His daddy didn't want him to keep it, but Lloyd had somehow persuaded him that he would take care of it and feed it out of his own allowance. He loved that rabbit, and he did take care of it. But the trouble was, things slipped his mind after a while. It had always been that way. And one day, while he was swinging idly in the tire that hung from the sickly maple behind their scraggy little house in Marathon, Pennsylvania, he had suddenly sat bolt upright, thinking of that rabbit. He hadn't thought of his rabbit in better than 2 weeks. It had just completely slipped his mind.
He ran to the little shed tacked onto the barn, and it had been summer just like it was now, and when he stepped into that shed, the bland smell of the rabbit had struck him in the face. The fur he'd liked so much to stroke was matted and dirty. White maggots crawled busily in the sockets that had once held his rabbit's pretty pink eyes. The rabbit's paws were ragged and bloody. He tried to tell himself that the paws were bloody because it had tried to scratch its way out of the cage, and that was undoubtedly how it had happened. But some sick, dark part of his mind spoke up in a whisper and said that maybe the rabbit, in the final extremity of its hunger, had tried to eat itself. Lloyd had taken the rabbit away, dug a deep hole, and buried it, still in its cage. His father had never asked him about the rabbit, might even have forgotten that his boy had a rabbit. Lloyd was not terribly bright, but he was a mental giant when stacked up against his daddy. But Lloyd had never forgotten. Always plagued by vivid dreams, the death of the rabbit had occasioned a series of horrible nightmares. And now the vision of the rabbit returned as he sat on his bunk with his knees drawn up to his chest, telling himself that someone would come, someone would surely come and let him go free. He didn't have this Captain Tripp's flu. He was just hungry, like his rabbit had been hungry, just like that. Sometime after midnight, he had fallen asleep, and this morning he had begun to work on the leg of his bunk. And now, looking at his bloody fingers, he thought with fresh horror about the paws of that long-ago rabbit, to whom he had meant no harm. By 1 o'clock on the afternoon of June 29th, he had the cot leg free. At the end, the bolt had given with stupid ease, and the leg had clanged to the floor of his cell, and he had just looked at it, wondering what in God's name he had wanted it for in the first place. It was about 3 feet long. He took it to the front of the cell and began to hammer furiously against the blued steel bars. "Hey!" he yelled as the clanging bar gave off its deep gong-like notes. "Hey, I want out! I want to get the fuck out of here, understand? Hey, goddammit, hey!" He stopped and listened as the echoes faded. For a moment, there was total silence, and then from the holding cell block came the rapturous, hoarse answer. "Mother, down here, Mother, I'm down here." "Jesus!" Lloyd cried, and threw the cot leg into the corner. He had struggled for hours, practically destroyed his fingers, just so he could wake that asshole up. He sat on his bunk, lifted the mattress, and took out a piece of rough bread. He debated adding a handful of dates, told himself he should save them, and snatched them up anyway. He ate them one by one, grimacing, saving the bread for last to take that slimy, fruity taste out of his mouth. When it was gone, he walked aimlessly to the right side of his cell. He looked down and stifled a cry of revulsion. Trask was sprawled half on his cot and half off it, and his pants legs had pulled up a little. His ankles were bare above the prison slippers they gave you to wear. A large, sleek rat was lunching on Trask's leg. Its repulsive pink tail was neatly coiled around its gray body. Lloyd walked to the other corner of his own cell and picked up the cot leg. He went back and stood for a moment, wondering if the rat would see him and decide to go off where the company wasn't quite so lively. But the rat's back was to him, and as far as Lloyd could tell, the rat didn't even know he was there. Lloyd measured the distance with his eye and decided the cot leg would reach admirably. "Huh," Lloyd grunted and swung the leg. It squashed the rat against Trask's leg, and Trask fell off his bunk with a stiff thump. The rat lay on its side, dazed, aspirating weakly. There were beads of blood in its whiskers. Its rear legs were moving, as if its ratty little brain was telling it to run somewhere, but along the spinal cord, the signals were getting all scrambled up. Lloyd hit it again and killed it. "There you are, you cheap fuck," Lloyd said. He put the cot leg down and wandered back to his bunk. He was hot and scared and felt like crying. He looked back over his shoulder and cried, "How do you like rat hell, you scuzzy little cocksucker?" "Mother," the voice cried happily in answer. "Mother!"
"Shut up!"
Lloyd screamed.
"I ain't your mother. Your mother's in charge of blowjobs at a whorehouse in asshole Indiana."
"Mother,"
the voice said, now full of weak doubt. Then it fell silent. Lloyd began to weep.
As he cried, he rubbed his eyes with his fists like a small boy. He wanted a steak sandwich. He wanted to talk to his lawyer. He wanted to get out of here. When he woke up again, it was 5 p.m., and maximum security was dead quiet. Blearily, Lloyd got off his cot, which now leaned drunkenly toward the spot where one of its supports had been taken away. He got the cot leg, steeled himself for the cries of mother, and began hammering on the bars like a farm cook calling the hired hands in for a big country supper. Supper. Now, there was a word. Had there ever been a finer? Ham steaks and potatoes with red-eye gravy and fresh new peas and milk with Hershey's chocolate syrup to dump in it. And a great big old dish of strawberry ice cream for dessert. No, there had never been a word to match supper.
Hey, ain't nobody there?
Lloyd cried, his voice breaking. No answer, not even a cry of mother. At this point, he might have welcomed it. Even the company of the mad was better than the company of the dead. Lloyd let the cot leg drop with a crash. He stumbled back to his bunk, turned up the mattress, and made inventory. 2 more hunks of bread, 2 more handfuls of dates, a half-gnawed pork chop, 1 piece of bologna. He pulled the slice of bologna in 2 and ate the big half, but that only whetted his appetite, brought it raging up. "No more," he whispered, then gobbled the rest of the pork off the chop bone, and then called himself names and wept some more. He was going to die in here, just as his rabbit had died in its cage, just as Trask had died in his. Trask. He looked into Trask's cell for a long, thoughtful time, watching the flies circle and land and take off. It was a regular L.A. International Airport for flies right on old Trask's face. At long last, Lloyd got the cot leg, went to the bars, and reached through it. By standing on tiptoe, he could just get enough length to catch the rat's body and drag it toward his cell. When it was close enough, Lloyd got on his knees and pulled the rat through to his side. He picked it up by the tail and held the dangling body before his eyes for a long time. Then he put it under his mattress, where the flies could not get at it, segregating the limp body from what remained of his food stash. He looked fixedly at the rat for a long time before letting the mattress fall back, mercifully hiding it from sight. "Just in case," Lloyd Henried whispered to the silence. "Just in case is all." Then he climbed up on the other end of the bunk, drew his knees up to his chin, and sat still. Chapter 26. For a long time, for days, how many days, who knew? Not the trash can man, that was for sure. Donald Merwin Elbert, known to the intimates of his dim and confusing grade school past as the trash can man, had wandered up and down the streets of Poutonville, Indiana, cringing from the voices in his head, dodging away and putting up his hands to shield against stones thrown by ghosts.
"Hey, trash can! Hey, trash can man, digging you, trash. Lit any good fires this week? What old Lady Semple say when you lit up her pension check, trash? Hey, trash baby, want to buy some kerosene? How'd you like those shock treatments down in Terre Haute, trashy? Trash, hey, trash can."
Sometimes he knew those voices weren't real, but sometimes he would cry out loud for them to stop, only to realize that the only voice was his own voice, hitting back at him from the houses and storefronts, bouncing off the cinder block wall of the scrub-a-dubba car wash, where he used to work, and where he now sat on the morning of June 30th, eating a big sloppy sandwich of peanut butter and jelly and tomatoes and Goulden's Diablo mustard. No voice but his voice, hitting the houses and stores and being turned away like an unwanted guest, and thus returning to his own ears. Because somehow, Poutonville was empty. Everyone was gone. Or were they? They said he was crazy, and that's something a crazy man would think, that his hometown was empty except for himself. But his eyes kept returning to the oil tanks on the horizon, huge and white and round, like low clouds. They stood between Poutonville and the road to Gary in Chicago, and he knew what he wanted to do, and that wasn't a dream. It was bad, but not a dream, and he wasn't going to be able to help himself. "Burn your fingers, trash? Hey, trash can man, don't you know playing with fire makes you wet the bed?" Something seemed to whistle past him, and he sobbed and held up his hands, dropping his sandwich into the dust, cringing his cheek into his neck. But there was nothing. There was no one. Beyond the cinder block wall of the scrub-a-dubba car wash, there was only Indiana Highway 130 going to Gary, but first going past the huge Cheery Oil Company holding tanks. Sobbing a little, he picked up his sandwich, brushed the gray dirt off the white bread as best he could, and began to munch it again. Were they dreams? Once his father had been alive, and the sheriff had cut him down in the street right outside the Methodist church, and he had had to live with that his whole life. "Hey, Trash, Sheriff Greeley cut your old man down just like a mad dog. You know that, you fucking weirdo?" His father had been in O'Toole's, and there was some bad talk, and Wendell Elbert had a gun, and he murdered the bartender with it, then went home and murdered Trashcan's two older brothers and his sister with it. Oh, Wendell Elbert was a strange fellow with a badass temper, and he had been getting flaky for a long time before that night. Anyone in Poutonville would tell you so. And they would tell you like father, like son. And he would have murdered Trashcan's mother, too, only Sally Elbert had fled screaming into the night with 5-year-old Donald, later to be known as the Trashcan Man, in her arms. Wendell Elbert had stood on the front steps, shooting at them as they fled, the bullets whining and striking on the road, and on the last shot, the cheap pistol, which Wendell had bought from a nigger in a bar located on Chicago's State Street, had exploded in his hand. The flying shrapnel had erased most of his face. He had gone wandering up the street with blood running in his eyes, screaming and waving the remainder of the cheap pistol in one hand, the barrel mushroomed and split like the remains of a novelty exploding cigar. And just as he got to the Methodist church, Sheriff Greeley pulled up in Poutonville's only squad car and commanded him to stand still and drop the gun. Wendell Elbert pointed the remains of his Saturday night special at the sheriff instead, and Greeley gave him both barrels of his over and under. "Hey, Trash, you burned your cock off yet?" He looked around for whoever had yelled that. It sounded like Carly Yates or one of the kids that hung out with him. Except Carly wasn't a kid anymore, any more than he was himself. Maybe he could be just Don Elbert again instead of the Trash Can Man. Just like Carly Yates was now just Carl Yates, who sold cars at the Stout Chrysler Plymouth dealership here in town. Except that Carl was gone. Everyone was gone. And maybe it was too late for him to be anyone anymore. And he wasn't sitting against the wall of the Scrub-a-Dubba anymore. He was a mile or more to the northwest of town, walking along 130, and the town of Poutonville was laid out below him like a scale model community on a kid's H.O. railroad table. The oil tanks were only half a mile away, and he had a toolkit in one hand and a 5-gallon can of gas in the other. Oh, it was so bad, but... So after Wendell Elbert had been put underground, Sally Elbert had gotten a job at the Poutonville Cafe, and sometime, in the first or second grade, her one remaining chick, Donald Merwin Elbert, had started lighting fires in people's trash cans and running away. "Look out, girls, here comes the Trash Can Man. He'll burn up your dresses." Eek! It wasn't until the third grade or so that the grown-ups found out who was doing it, and then the sheriff came around. Good old Sheriff Greeley. And he guessed that was how the man who cut his father down in front of the Methodist church ended up being his stepfather. "Hey, Carly, got a riddle for you. How can your father kill your father?" "I don't know, Petey, how?" "I don't know either, but it helps if you're the Trash Can Man." "Hee, hee, hee, ha, ha, ha." He was standing at the head of the gravel drive now, his shoulders aching from carrying the toolkit and the gas. The sign on the gate read, "Cheery Petroleum Company, Incorporated. All visitors must check in at the office. Thanks." A few cars were parked in the lot, not many. Many were standing on flats. Trash Can Man walked up the drive and slipped through the gate, which was standing ajar. His eyes, blue and strange, were fixed on the spidery stairs that wound around the nearest tank in a spiral, all the way to the top. There was a chain across the bottom of these stairs, and another sign swung from the chain. This one said, "Keep off. Pumping station closed." He stepped over the chain and started up the stairs. It wasn't right, his mother marrying that Sheriff Greeley. The year he was in the fourth grade, he had started lighting fires in mailboxes. That was the year he burned up old Mrs. Semple's pension check, and he got caught again. Sally Elbert Greeley went into hysterics the one time her new husband mentioned sending the boy to that place down in Terre Haute.
You think he's crazy? How can a 10-year-old boy be crazy? I think you just want to get rid of him. You got rid of his father, and now you want to get rid of him.
The only other thing Greeley could do was to bring the boy up on charges, and you can't send a kid of 10 off to reform school, not unless you want him to come out with a size 11 asshole, not unless you wanted your new wife to divorce you. Up the stairs and up the stairs. His feet made little ringing noises on the steel. He had left the voices down below, and no one could throw a stone this high. The cars in the parking lot looked like twinkling corgi toys. There was only the wind's voice, talking low in his ear and moaning an event somewhere. That, and the far-off call of a tree. Trees and open fields spread out all around, all in shades of green, only slightly blued by a dreaming morning haze. He was smiling now, happy, as he followed the steel spiral up and up, around and around. When he got to the tank's flat circular cap, it seemed that he must be standing directly under the roof of the world, and if he reached up, he could scratch blue chalk from the bottom of the sky with his fingernails. He put the gas can and the toolkit down and just looked. From here, you can actually see Gary, because the industrial smokes that usually poured from its factory stacks were absent, and the air up that way was as clear as it was down here. Chicago was a dream wrapped in summer haze, and there was a faint blue glint to the far north that was either Lake Michigan or just wishful thinking. The air had a soft golden aroma that made him think of a calm breakfast in a well-lighted kitchen, and soon the day would burn. Leaving the gas where it was, he took the toolkit over to the pumping machinery and began to puzzle it out. He had an intuitive grasp of machinery. He could handle it the way certain idiot savants can multiply and divide seven-digit numbers in their heads. There was nothing thoughtful or cognitive about it. He simply let his hands wander here and there for a few moments, and then his hands would move with quick, effortless confidence. "Hey, trash can, why'd you want to burn up a church? Why didn't you burn up the school?" When he was in the fifth grade, he had started a fire in the living room of a deserted house in the neighboring town of Sedley, and the house burned flat. His stepfather, Sheriff Greeley, put him in the cooler because a gang of kids had beaten him up, and now the grown-ups wanted to start. Why, if it hadn't rained, we could have lost half the township thanks to that goddamn firebug kid. Greeley told Sally that Donald would have to go down to that place in Terre Haute and have the tests. Sally said she would leave him if he did that to her baby, her only chick. But Greeley went ahead and got the judge to sign the order. And so the trash can man left Powhatanville for a while, for 2 years, and his mother divorced the sheriff, and later that year the voters disowned the sheriff, and Greeley ended up going to Gary to work in an auto assembly line. Sally came to see Trash every week and always cried. Trash can whispered, "There you are, motherfuck," and then looked around furtively to see if anyone had heard him. Of course no one had, because he was on top of Cheery Oil's number one storage tank. And even if he had been down on the ground, there was no one left. Except for ghosts. Above him, fat white clouds floated by. A large pipe projected out of the tangle of pumping machinery, its bore better than 2 feet, its end threaded to take what the oil people called a clutch hose. It was strictly for outflow or overflow, but the tank was now full of unleaded gasoline, and some of it had trickled out, perhaps a pint, cutting shiny tracks through the light dust on the tank. Trash can stood back, eyes bright, still gripping a large wrench in one hand and a hammer in the other. He dropped them, and they clanged. He wouldn't need the gasoline he'd brought after all. He picked up the can, yelled, "Bombs away!" and dropped it over the side. He watched its tumbling, glinting progress with great interest. A third of the way down, it hit the stairs, bounced off, and then fell all the way to the ground, turning over and over, spraying amber gas from the side that had been punched open when it hit the stairs. He turned back to the outflow pipe. He looked at the shiny puddles of gasoline. He took a package of paper matches from his breast pocket and looked at them, guilty and fascinated and excited. There was an ad on the front that said you could get an education in most anything you wanted at the LaSalle Correspondence School in Chicago. I'm standing on a bomb, he thought. He closed his eyes, trembling in fear and ecstasy, the old cold excitement on him, making his toes and fingers feel numb. Hey, Trash, you fucking firebug,